And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I'd stay going. So I opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are, and we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know. And it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today, because, like, I'm heartbroken.
Year of the sunshine, the year 54, we said that we'd sail across the sea. A bunch of the boys, all natives of the town, we were going on a voyage, you see. With a lovely little boat, and when ready to float, she was the nicest that e'er you've seen. When not from digging with his hand, the brass and reed band, they played us to the Port Alicia Queen.
Pat Critchley is a Port Leash and Leash legend. Not only is he Leash's only ever hurling all-star, he lined out with the Leash footballers as well and was a brilliant basketballer too. He won 14 county titles for Port Leash, 7 in football and 7 in hurling, along with an All-Ireland club title for the footballers and 3 Leinster clubs. He went on to manage the Leash senior hurlers, beating Kilkenny in the league and losing by only 2 points to them in the championship. He managed Aerobe footballers to a Leinster title and he's currently training the Port Leash footballers. He managed the Leash ladies to 2 Leinster titles. He managed Carlo IT footballers to a Sigerson Cup final. He was PE teacher in Presentation College Port Leash, where he managed their basketball and football teams to numerous All-Ireland titles and was awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award by Basketball Ireland. He's also been honoured with a Leinster GAA Hall of Fame Award. I haven't even mentioned the huge work he's done at underage and development level with hurling and football in Leash, and the fact that he wrote a book in his spare time. It's called Hungry Hill. I'm delighted to say Pat joins us on the line now. Pat, you're too modest for an introduction like that.
Hi, Wally, yeah, it's been a busy time over the years, like, but I was just saying that, you know, I remember Brian Cody mentioned there a year or two back that, you know, people said, you put in a fierce sacrifice, like, it never feel like you don't do something for that length of time without loving it, like, you just love the coaching and it's not a chore, you know, it's something that enjoy and something I'm missing at the moment, obviously with the lockdown, and hoping to get back pretty soon. I think we'll be letting the youngsters out into the fields at the end of this month or the end of April next month. We're looking forward to that.
It's definitely an addiction for you, Pat, because like I said, some people say to me the odd time, why don't you manage a team? And I said, geez, I'm working all day in GAA. I couldn't be doing it again in the evening. I'd be driven mad. Like, I mean, you're working, managing and coaching teams. You're a PE teacher for all those years. And even in the evenings then, you know, you're taking other teams.
I got into coaching actually through necessity when I joined the basketball club back in the 70s. I was only 16 and there was no one to coach in the 14s, you know, and so I started coaching in 1976 through necessity, but I just grew to love it then, you know, and it's probably the reason why I went on to become a teacher and a PE teacher. And but I think over the years in the teacher, I took a career break and did a round trip around the world, and I think those little breaks and kind of recharging the batteries, and then I did as a conman with Leash GAA for 3 years, and then went back to the school again. You would go back to the school with renewed energy, and probably everyone probably needs that in their career breaks on it.
Yeah, that's true. I believe in Presentation College you had some run-ins with the nuns in 1985 when you wanted to start up the football in Camogie.
Yeah, it was a different world. Like, you know, they felt that the ladies' football was too unladylike, you know, and it was too rough, and there was volleyball and basketball. The volleyball was no contact at all, like, and the basketball was allowed, but the first year we weren't allowed the football, but we got to go on the second year and did well from then on. Elaine Hayes captain our basketball team to win Nellar, but she was also on the first football team that won the Nellar, and there was no A's or B's or C's or anything at that time.
Right.
And then her daughter captained the team to win the Senior A there 2 years ago. It's actually 2 years ago this week. So there was a we got going on the football, and you know, at that time there were very few schools playing. You know, it's incredible the explosion of interest and the raising of the standards in that game over a relatively short period of time in those intervening years.
To
an extent where you know the attendances at the Ladies All Ireland's, like, you know, massive, like you know, getting those type of crowds following the support in the game.
Yeah, and obviously the Portlaoise ladies won the county final this year, which was a big one for Portlaoise as well. You mentioned being over to basketball since you were 16, but you were a Laois manager in the mid-90s. Like, I mean, you only must have been just after finishing up your own career at that stage.
Yeah, towards the end of the 80s, I got knee injuries. I had a big problem with the lining of the bone in the knee, and really kind of finished my playing career a little bit earlier than I would have. I did play on basketball, but not at a serious level for a number of years after that. So it wouldn't have been that long having finished. Probably looking back on it, Willie, I'd say it was probably a little bit young for it as well. You know, I'd admit mistakes that you look back on now, like an obvious one that I would think is that, you know, everyone's kind of nostalgic for their own era and stuff, and
yeah.
I probably would have been harping on about the 80s team, you know, that team didn't want to be hearing about the 80s team, they wanted to hear about the 90s team, you know, their team and what was relevant for them at the time. At the same time, we had a great run of it. We got an awful beating in the championship the first year against Wexford, and but the following year, like, we came damn close to beating. We beat Kilkenny in the league earlier that year, and came very close to beating them over in Carlow in the championship. Dave save at the end by the Kilkenny goalie, like, kept us out. And I remember in that league game, remember hearing that we played the Offaly in the Leinster final 85, and Laois were in both Leinster finals that year, and but they went for the jugular early on, and they scored three goals against us. We'd normally have very tight games against them, but they beat us well that day. And I heard anecdotally after that, they said that you beat Laois in the first 10 minutes, but you have to beat Kilkenny in the last 10 minutes, you know. So I remember in that league game, we prepared the guys mentally for that last 10 minutes against Kilkenny. And at that time, you know, a manager could go wherever he liked, like, I was in behind the goals there, and shouting in last 10, you know, Sir Duggan's team, Mel Reaney and the boys, and it was like the Alamo, but they held out against them for the last 10 minutes. It was a great victory for us at that time.
You mentioned comparing the 90s teams to the 80s team, but that would be understandable considering no matter who I talk to now, even now, and they talk about Laois hurling, they talk about the 80s team. And, like, I mean, you got to a Leinster finalist, you didn't win anything, but you're remembered incredibly fondly, not just within Laois, like outside of Laois as well.
Yeah, it was a massive run we had, or in the sense that I was very lucky that my first year, I went down to the team in 1980, and the very first year we came from 11 points down to beat Tipperary in the National League quarter final, and Offaly beat us by a point in the National League semi final, and they beat us by a point in the Leinster semi final, and they went down and won the All Ireland, and throughout the year, you know, we beat Kilkenny, and we lost Kilkenny in another National League semi-final. And at the time, you see, you didn't get any second doors in the championship. Like, it was, you lost, you were out. Like, we awfully beat us after a replay in 82 and got caught by Dublin in 83. But 84, we had a massive run. Like, we beat Kilkenny in a knockout game in the National League, and Tipperary was in the quarterfinal. But then there was a Centenary Cup that year in 84. And Limerick had won the National League, and we played them in the first round. We gave them a guard of honour going onto the pitch, and then we beat them by a pint. And And then the following Sunday, we beat Tipperary in the quarter final by a pint on Nolan Park. And the following Sunday, we beat Galway by a pint in Turles. And then Cork beat as well in the following Sunday in the final. And then the fifth Sunday, we lost to Kilkenny in the championship. You know, but the buzz around the county that time was incredible. Like, you know, going to the matches and the streams of supporters, because they hadn't seen anything like that since the 40s, you know. And to be playing these type of teams and beating them was new. Like, and I remember even my first year when we beat Tipperary, there was you know, Liam O'Neill's dad, Billy O'Neill, and Billy Bowen played in the 49 final. Billy O'Neill played in the 34 minor All-Ireland, but they were crying in the dressing room, you know. Right. These days, like, it was almost revenge for 49 kind of thing, you know. But it was a massive time to be playing, and we'd a fabulous team, like, as well, you know. Really good hurlers.
That coincided, obviously, with a brilliant Portlaoise team that came along, and we'll get on to that in a few minutes. Was it Georgie Leahy that kind of turned the fortunes around, or was it a good team that came through, Pat? Because I was reading a good one about someone said, I think it was you said it, that Leash went down to play Limerick and scored 2 points. And someone said afterwards, look, Leash went down to Limerick to get 2 points and they got 2 points. It was a National League game. Like, I mean, this was, I suppose, just before that good team came along.
It was a combination. Like, Charger brought a great confidence into the team, you know, and it coincided with a really good group, and it was great camaraderie. There's great little characters around it as well, you know, Scobie Wild, Castellan, Sabu Wheel, and there was a great story. Eugene Fennelly was a fabulous hurler with us from Abeleeks, and when we played Offaly in that 81 Leinster semi-final, it was a double bill, like Wexford were playing Kilkenny in the second game. And so it was the first really big game that Leash hurlers played in Croke Park for years. It was probably going to be 40,000, 50,000 there. And there's a little area called Killamuck Everlations there in Abeleeks. They hired a minibus and they parked in Parnell Square, but one of the guys got lost from the rest of them, and so there was hundreds going through the turnstiles at the canal end, and it was not released that overheard him, and he got to the stiles to pay his money. And he signed out to Killamuck boys, you know, like, and we slagged Eugene Fennelly for years after that, like, when we were going to a match, and he signed out to Killamuck boys, are they coming today, you know. So it was it was this huge It was a totally different experience for the supporters, these type of games at the time.
Yeah, they got lost. That's the old joke.
Yeah.
Come here. So 1985 obviously was an unbelievable year for you, because, like you said, you made the Leinster final. You got hammered with, I think the final score was 5-15 to 17 points. So, you know, it was the goals obviously that killed you, but you had a brilliant win against Dublin, a brilliant win against Wexford, and for your performances, that year, your Leash's only ever hurling all-star. Like, I mean, you must be very proud of that.
Yeah, we got myself and John Taylor got replacement all-stars the year before. At that time, we were on the all-star trip in 85, like, we just got back. Things went really well in the Dublin match and the Wexford match. Not so good in the final, and at that time there might be a few highlights, but there wouldn't be games televised, you know. And because of Leash's run and getting to the Leinster final, you're probably going to get one all-star. That was kind of the way of it, but unfortunately John Taylor was sent off in the Dublin National League game, and that was the rule at the time. So
right,
I'd say it would have been John Taylor's all-star, you know. John should have probably won two or three All-Stars around that time, you know, but you had to be kind of getting into that level of the championship to have any chance of getting one, like, you know. So there was only one got at the time, but it definitely would have been John, except for those circumstances.
Well, I do. Anytime I have a conversation around you getting an All-Star and Portlaoise or Leash, Pat should have got one, but Jesus, John Taylor should have got one as well back in those times.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like, it was an incredible hurler. and you know, there were savage players, you know, PJ Martin Cuddy and Maggie Welsh is the only one that we've lost from that team. God rest him. You know, Christy Jones, John Delaney, Billy Bowen, and Eugene Fenley, as I mentioned, there's so many. The other thing that I forgot to mention, the 84 centenary final in the Kilkenny Championship, like it was that Tom Flynn got a cruci that time that finished his career, and we're also missing John Bowen for those two games, which were huge losses for us as well, you know, at that time.
Right.
But there was some fantastic players there, and many of whom could have got an All-Star.
When you got the All-Star, how did you find out about it? Like, I mean, presumed it was a ceremony. It's not like you get a text now or the heads up. Did you find out on the night, or how did it all work back in 85?
That year, the hurlers had been told before the night, and they were announcing the football, and then they used to reverse it every year. Like, I do remember getting a message to ring. I think it was in the car. I could have been up visiting a friend of mine, Paul Marin, at the time, but I'm not sure. I remember ringing from a kiosk in Monastrevin, and it was Mick Dunn. He was a Leishman as well. He was chairperson of the selectors, and he was thrilled being from Leash as well to give the news, and that was prior to the night.
Right. Okay. And like, I mean, obviously travelled up the night and few drinks, celebrate, become Alicia's first ever All-Star.
Yeah, so like, I didn't drink till I was 23, you know. Then someone said I could have made up for it after that, but with the first night of it. I remember we were playing a basketball tournament out in Portrane, leaving the following morning the hotel for to go to play the basketball, and still under the weather, like for the first game, and Ireland were playing Wales in the rugby, and at some stage during the day, like we had several games during the day, some of the rest of the team went on the beer watching the match, like, and by the time our last game played, I was probably the only one sober, or one of the few ones that were sober. That was the day after the All-Star. We had a good crack of it. Like, I think there was a party out in Ollie Plunkett's in Grosvenor Park. There was a few Leash guys up at that following night.
So it must have been a great time to be playing, Pat. Like, I mean, Leash going well for the first time in such a long time. You're winning all Ireland clubs with the footballers. The Portlaoise hurlers are winning, you know, which at that time wouldn't have been used to be winning at all. Like, I mean, I was reading when you were under 21, you were lining out for 15 teams. Like, I mean, you're a busy man.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Now, you know, it was a golden age for the club as well, you know. Both hurling and football, the football Ireland win 83, like, was a highlight, but winning the first hurling county final in 1981, because Portlaoise hadn't won it since 1943. It was almost 40 years. It was a massive thing for it to happen. Now we had won 221, actually 79 or 21. We won another one in 81. So there was good young players coming, and Nasser Lawler, and then they got Jimmy Dial up to train the team with Nasser, and Nasser hooked in. Like, so I suppose when you're looking back now, like, whether they knew it or not, the psychology that these guys would use, like, Jimmy Dial would be talking about, they're talking down in Tipperary about this great young Portlaoise team, like, you know, to be known down in Tipperary talking about us. Nasser, I remember, came in and said he used to play golf. He's a member of Madrat, and he pulled in for a pint, and he told us he was in Eddie Kerwin's, and he said there was a few Commerce lads in there, and the only team that they're worried about is this young Portlaoise team, you know, like, they're worried about them because of their skill and that they're hardy hurlers, and they'd be known from Commerce worrying about us at that stage either, you know, like, although we narrowly lost them in 80, but he also hooked in. Nasser coming up to that final that you see in the in the early part of the last century, nearly all of the hurling county winners were from the Kilkenny end of the county, that end of the county. Kilcotton and Ballygeen and those. So he hooked onto this old saying that was that the county final cup would never cross the Gully Bridge, and the Gully Bridge was this side of Ballycollar, between Eboleese and Ballycollar. But that year, Moor Park was closed down, so the final was fixed for that Downey. So we could actually carry the cup over the Gully. He hooked in on this all the week coming up to the final, that would be the first team to carry the O'Keefe Cup across the Gully Bridge, you know. And so after the win and everything, we stopped the bus and we carried Nasser over the bridge. It's a great memory. Like, they were going to throw him into the river then, it would have killed him, because there was not many rocks in the river.
I'd say that probably was a bit of psychology about Tipperary or Camaras not speaking about that Portlaoise team. But when you look at it, Pat, it was the when you won the first one, it was the first time in 40 years. Portlaoise have only, just to give it a bit of context, Portlaoise have only ever won 11 hurling county titles, and you and Cheddar's group of hurlers won 7 of them in 11 years.
Yeah, it was a huge. It was a huge time to be playing. It was great, and it kind of came. I think from there was some brilliant Christian brothers in the primary school back in the 60s and early 70s. Brother Brazan, Brother Summers, Brother Kelly, Brother Ging, and they were all great coaches as well as teachers, and then you had Bill Phelan in the juvenile committee, and then all our dads got involved in the juvenile committee, and all of that came true into the hurling football in the 80s, you know. Players like Curley and Colin Brown in the football, and all the hurlers that came through those years where the Christian Brothers were so strong in that primary school.
So, as I was saying, 1985 was such a great year for you, obviously the All-Star, and you were heading into a county final. It was a 5-in-a-row county final, and you went and you played Dublin in a National League game in November, and you accidentally caught Paul Mulhere, which you followed through, and he tragically died, I think it was a day after, Pat, and I know you don't often talk about this, and I appreciate you doing it. What do you remember about what happened that day?
It was a basketball move that I used to make. I wasn't even aware of it at the time. I remember coaching. I remember there was Nolan Keane and Jimmy's sister. I was coaching her and she would be going with her dad, the Bomber, to all the hurling matches. And it was a minor match that I played against Dublin over in Tullamore. And when I was coaching that Tuesday, I said, I saw you doing the spin move, you know, and where you kind of draw in a player as if you were striking maybe right-handed, and then you use what we call a reverse pivot in the basketball and strike left-handed, you know, and it was that kind of move, but whatever way it worked out, it connected with Paul's helmet on the swivel, you know, and I was in the PE hall down in the convent on the Monday in between class, and had the radio on, and just this announcement came on the radio, and I just put shivers through me, like that. I kind of knew that it was a Dublin hurler. I'd gone into hospital, and Paul lived for a few days. Then after that, and been up, and but the whole week was kind of like a blur, you know. And but the Dublin players, were brilliant to me, and they wanted me to play the game, to get back on and play like We lost John Taylor as well, but I did come on in the game, but we still only lost the game by a point. But I think maybe if I hadn't come on, we maybe might have had a better chance of winning the game. But I remember Pat Malloy was the chairman, and the meal after, he said, "Look, we know we lost the county final, but it was great to have Pat back playing, you know." So, and I suppose like over the next while, like sport is kind of therapeutic, you know, that when you cross the line and you're playing, like, it puts everything out of your mind a little bit for that hour, and whether you're coaching or playing, you know. So that's probably how it happened. But it was just an awful thing to deal with. The only side of it was that it was purely accidental, you know. But I know for years after, like, you would feel like, especially if you were, you know, out celebrating a county final or out with the old band, and you were enjoying yourself, there would be a feeling of guilt that you were out, you know, just fate, like, that you were out there kind of enjoying yourself and Paul wasn't, you know. That would have lingered, like, you know, for a long time afterwards.
Right. Even still, like, I mean, even though, like, it was a freak accident.
Yeah. And, it's 36 years now, like, but still would be, I was unfortunate to be involved in a fatal car accident just in recent years, like, just down the road from where I live, like, you know. And, I would always have just a private ritual. If it was any time driving to Dublin, once I get to the sign for ACCO, I bless myself, you know. But and I do the same for Willie here, which means, like, every single day, like, you would do that. Yeah.
God, it's terrible. The thing about the Paul accident, Pat, is that he was wearing a helmet and he had played on. So I presume it wouldn't have even been in your head that there was anything after happening.
No, not until that that radio announcement,
right,
and the news the following morning. Yeah,
and you headed up to Dublin then, did you?
I stayed with my brother Mick, and the family were brilliant to me, and all Dublin, Jimmy Gray, and all the guys there. Chiller and John Bowen come up to the funeral with me.
She's absolutely terrible. And you mentioned that you came on at half time in the county final. I presume, you know, after spending the week that, you know, that you did, coming on at half time maybe helps you a little bit, or I don't know, took your mind off it, like you said. Cheddar told me it was the biggest and longest ovation he's ever heard at a GAA match when you came on.
Yeah, I probably didn't even touch the ball. To be honest, I don't have any real great recollection of the game at all, really. People would have said that to me afterwards about the moment of coming on and everything, but I just don't have it in my memory, you know.
Right. How long, Pat, did it take before you kind of, I don't know, got back to being yourself, if you could?
Probably the sport was good, and that you just get stuck into it again, you know. I remember after Dad's that we had a big basketball match down in St Mary's Hall. It was a cup match, so you were allowed the whole school over, and we were playing Jerry Terrence Listow, like, we would been way rank outsiders, and Jesus, the girls put in a massive display, like, just the emotion, and I do remember that emotion. And all, and we lost by a pint or two, but it was incredible display. And I suppose they were trying to give you a bit of a boost, you know, after the tragedy of losing your dad, you know. So sport can be good that way, you know. You immerse yourself in it, and it does take your mind off these things, and helps you to heal, you know.
The 1985 five in a row game was obviously, it was against Camross, and they beat you by a goal in the last minute, and that was going for the five in a row. Like, I mean, I was just a young boy in the 80s. I probably remember the 1989 final, the big row. I would have been 11 for that. Jesus, you had some battles with Camross back then, Pat. You met each other the whole time. You were the two best teams in Laois by a mile.
Yeah, I think we would have met Earl in 82, Carmers in 83, and the Harps then come on the scene in 84, and I don't know who I met there during the week. We were chatting about, but the 84 said he'd climb over a wall to watch a match. Like at the minute, you know, at the, even last summer there when lads weren't allowed to go into the matches. But in 84, we won four county finals in four different venues, like Rathdowney, Boris, Montreat, and then the centenary final was in a Moore Park. But the county board opened the Moore Park for the play of the finals, and it wasn't really ready. We won the football final after a replay against Ballyroan. Actually, Port Leash won the two minors that year as well. It was a brilliant year for the club. But with the hurling, there was just too much sand on the pitch. And getting back to the Nasser again, like we had just leased out a second field in the club, like, and. So after the drawn game, then after we're trying in the backfield there tonight, like, so what the hell? Has he lost a head? Like the backfield was brutal pitch, like to getting ready for a county final. So we went through the ditch. He brought us over to the corner here. He had a ladder in the ditch, and we climbed over the ladder, and we went in, and we just poked balls down the lines, getting used to the bounce, you know, like, and in Georgie Lai had a meeting to start. Georgie would be always giving out about the pitches in Leash, like with the grass just, and the hills and all sorts. And so someone said, why can't we train in Moore Park? Like, George said, so the county board won't let us train in the Moore Park. And Joe Keenan forgot where he was. So we got get a ladder like we did and go over the top. The Commerce lads and the Harps lads and everything else. So that was 84. But I think Port Leash and Commerce won all the finals of the 80s.
Won them all, yeah.
And probably meeting to each other too many times, you know, like I played over in San Francisco actually with Ray Sheeran, God rest him, played against Ray in the 81 final with Commerce, and Leash and Cork lads would have formed the club in the Fianna, and with Mick Darcy and from Montreat and Ray Sheeran, they had the black and amber jerseys. So Ray used to slag me over that. I was playing with him with the Commerce jerseys. But over there was only two teams some years, like, and they played the best of seven, you know. And it just got too caustic, like when you were playing the same team over and over, you know.
Yeah.
Boiled over a little bit in 89 then, you know.
It boiled over a fair bit, because I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and he said, like I said, we were 11 at that stage, and he was up in the stand crying because he thought Cheddar was after being killed in 1989, when that whole thing. I have a very clear recollection of Jimmy Keenan being put marking. Was it PJ Cuddy? Because PJ Cuddy was like the big kind of, like a big bully, I suppose, a good hurler, but everybody was afraid to mark him except for Jimmy Keenan. And I don't know, like, I mean, like, was it completely toxic, that rivalry, or would there have been friendships then off the field?
It was actually Martin Cuddy.
Martin Cuddy, that was it.
Between PJ and Martin. But Jimmy spoke for Martin at the hearing, you know, like, and would have great respect for Martin, PJ, and all the guys, like, It just built over that day, and it wasn't nice, but sure, it happened, and you know, but there would be great friendships, like there's great respect between hurlers, you know, like fantastic hurlers like Frank Keenan. Derby, I just missed out playing with Frank. He just finished just before I started. Fabulous hurler, and I worked with had great times with Big Sean Cuddy with Leash. Like afterwards, fantastic. He'd see great sayings, and I remember we played a practice match. Niall Reidney would tell you about against Waterford. We got a bit of a hiding, and Sean got all the jerseys, and threw them on, put the forwards put the jerseys in one pile in the midfield, so there was three piles of jerseys. And he said he went to the backs, like Leash only scored 8 points against Waterford, like the backs, they feel that sweat, like, and the midfielders feel that sweat. The forwards, dry as snuff, he says, 8 points in an hour, is it? I often drank 8 points in an hour. and he'd have a great way about him, like, and, you know, we got on, like a house of fire with those Leash teams that were managing.
I think your managerial career, there's been so many teams, Pat, but the one I thought was interesting was Aeroge. And I was old enough to remember this, you know, fairly well, that Aeroge obviously won four Leinsters, unlucky not to win an All-Ireland, you know, that was heartbreaking. I don't know what it was about Portlaoise. We always used to be listening to Aeroge back then and hoping that they'd win it. And then they lost the county final the year after their fourth Leinster. Were they beaten in the All-Ireland final that year, the semi-final, I think, maybe? And everybody thought they went on the following year then and lost the county final. And the whole talk then was, that's the end of that Aeroge team. So some people might think it's an attractive job, but when you took them over, it probably wasn't looking like that attractive a job. Even, I think the players even themselves thought they'd come to the end of the road.
I remember I went over to have a meeting with them. Turlough O'Brien was the main man organising at the time. But when I met with Turlough and the committee, they actually had I said that when they set up about putting things in place, they had tried to emulate Portlaoise, you know, what Portlaoise had done in the 80s. You know, they say that whereas Carlow or Laois might have been winning Leinsters or All-Irelands, clubs from Carlow or Laois could, you know. And but I remember they saying to me that night that there's some of the older lads think that they're having another shout in them, but if you want to just develop a whole new team and develop again, that's fine as well, you know. So we got going at it, and you know, some of the others like Garvin Weir and Joe Murphy was the captain, and we were training away until then we had just a meeting after training one night, and it just blew up, look, and they went like, just Pat, you know that four call in line, sort of like Joe Murphy said, we should be doing 10 of those, you know, and they really look for it. You knew you kind of had them then, you know, like they were looking to be driven then, you know. And I remember Tuesday night, Joe crawling over the line, at four call end line, and said, just Joe, you were going to do 10 of those the other night, you know. You could have a crack there as well, like you have to have that bit of crack, like. And but then we just got on a road, and I do remember Joe had retired from the inter-county, but we got a practice match against Mullingar, and we went up to watch Carlow play Westmead, and we had a very poor performance. It was dire, like, and got well beaten, and set into the bus with Joe, like, and just after a beating like that, like I said, Joe, Pat, the biggest problem we'll have is getting out of Carlow. If we can get out of Carlow, he says, everything will kick in, like, we have the tradition, like, you know. And it's an amazing thing to say just after so poor a practice game, but that's actually the way it happened. Once we won Carlow, just the whole thing took off, and it took three games to win against Kilmacud, like, and we only scraped the first two, like, we just dogged it out, like. And Willie Quinlan got injured. I remember driving Willie to the Star had needed to get an injection with his ribs, like, but the cartilage had tore away, like. And but he was talking about some player that got back in a week, you know. He was wanting to play the following Sunday. he wanted to get this injection. I remember driving down after the Leinster final to Carlow to get this injection. But he didn't get back the following Sunday. But then after Christmas, then he had a super game for us. He got an early goal that really set us up. We played brilliant football in the Turra game. And over the Christmas, we... because it was unusual, like the three games and having to get over it. We got Fiona Kelly, who was the PE teacher in Leo's, and you were from the basketball, and we stopped doing the outdoor and went in. We did a little bit of indoor soccer and indoor hockey and basketball and threw in a few drills as well. But it really kind of worked for us. Like it changed the thing up a little bit, and then we got going again after the Christmas break. That worked really well for us that time as well.
But Cross McGlen ended up beating you then. That was that brilliant Cross McGlen team, but nobody expected that Leinster, and especially, you know, the three games against Kilmacrokes. Joe Murphy speaks very fondly of you, Pat. He was saying, we haven't done a lap of the field all year. He's been a breath of fresh air, and you'd have a unique enough probably coaching style. Well, everything's done with the ball anyway. I know that, you know, most of it's done with the ball. And in the 90s, I suppose, especially at club level, that would have been very unusual.
Yeah, like let's say over the years, like I think you got a smart use of time, you know, and so the more that you're using the ball, the better. Like we probably might have lost that that balance, you know, in recent years. Like I think sometimes we look at professional game and we take aspects of the professional game, but sometimes coaches don't adapt that to training an amateur team. You know, like for example, like I remember there was huge emphasis on the SAC, the speed, agility, quickness programs. You know, so like there was, you know, the hurdles and the ladders and.
Yeah.
I found that equipment brilliant for nursery in the primary schools, senior infants, and setting up little games, you know, with those, like the Olympics we played and all of that. But in actual fact, looking at a lot of clubs, like sometimes they were spending half an hour on the sack, and if they were only training twice a week, that was a third of their training time was gone doing sack. And then when you looked at it, technically a lot of the players didn't have good fundamental footwork for the sidestep, for beating players, for a drop step. We'd be used to that from the basketball. Like from the word go into basketball, footwork was a fundamental of the game, you know. And but I didn't find it, the footwork was coached very well in the GA, you know, if at all. And sometimes you got to have smart use of time, like, and probably doing laps of the field back in the 90s wasn't probably smart use of time, and you know, so we would keep everything with the ball and keep everything dynamic, and it worked for us at that time.
Yeah, I remember Colin Brown, when he was the Laois manager, was a huge fan of those ladders and those things. We spent a lot of time running in around them. You name your warm-ups and everything, don't you, Pat? The Carlow IT lads responded really well to them. You give your different drills different names.
Yeah. Well, see, like we call kind of name the game, like, or name drill. We've from the years, over the years in the school, like it brings a huge sharpness to it. So you might need to explain something when you're doing it for the first time, you know. But after that, they know, like the girls could be playing a fast break game, and. If Red have the ball, if I blow the whistle, stop the game, I'll throw the ball to the black team and shout, you know, two teams shooting 20, number one, you know, like, and immediately they're sprinting to the basket. They know that it's the drill is two teams shooting, that they've got to score 20 to win, and they've got to shoot from the number one spot.
Right.
You know, all in a split second. And probably if number one is closest to the basket, so like when they've good technique, like you're gonna hit 90% there. So probably the team that gets the first shot away is probably going to win, you know, unless they make too many mistakes on the shots. Like so that shouting the name going, and it quickens the mind, like, and quickens the reactions, and it makes players sharper, because it's a very fast, sharp game, and that's the way you've got to train. So the name in the game really helps that. Like, I found, and also, like, you're not you're not saying you go to the blue marker and then you come back here and you go to the green marker. You know, like they're more concerned with where they're supposed to be going than what they're doing, you know. And so you don't have that, like the one question I would be asked over the years if people ring you or meet you, like, for Pat, would you have a good drill for a bit of variety, you know? And and like, you know, I'd make the point, it's, you know, it's not a variety show. Like, what do you want the drill to do? And the point to make, like, variety is fine, but not at the detriment of the reinforcement, the diligent reinforcement of the fundamentals of the game, you know, which you need to do, like, and the reinforcement of your game plan, like, mainly through phase games and playing games and putting names in those games helps that.
I think that's the big thing. I was only talking about that on the show not so long ago, and the drills, and you could spend 50 minutes going through from drill to drill, and they might have no relevance to a game, and neither are they connected to a game by the manager. And it's just like, why, you know, some managers might be proud of themselves that they might know 10 different drills and move you around, and they're kind of irrelevant, like you say, as a variety show, unless you're making some connection with them and what you want to do.
Yeah, I think every single thing you do, and like sometimes we might be doing the Laszlo drill with the post that would have adapted from basketball to the football, but I would explain to the guy, listen, like, as we turn over that ball and we want to catapult up the field at pace, like, we need to be able to handle the ball at ferocious pace, explosive pace. That's what we're doing. That's why we're doing this drill, and we need to do it well, you know. And so, like, they're given a lot of their time, so they need to know why you're doing things, and if you're not able to tell them, then you have to question why you're doing it yourself, you know. And sometimes it's the game, like first year basketball, we would have a very basic game, and it's just pass forward game, you know, and basically there's no dribbling, so it's putting pressure on the girl's footwork. Like, when she catches the ball, she has to pivot and scan to see what's there. Now, there's nothing ahead of her. She can't pass sideways, can't pass back. That's the only. As the Dumbledore says, a simple old game. Like, it's a huge game in that. The huge emphasis on that is what's happening off the ball. So you can't play the game without good off the ball movement, you know, and eventually then you start getting a player getting in a forward position for it to get the ball, so you're moving the ball quicker up the court. But eventually then you get a player reading it two passes ahead, so that they're reading where the ball is going to go, and they're going to be ahead of that again, you know. And then once across the 3-pointer, we allow them to recycle and swing the ball, because you're not going to pass it over the end line, you know. But it's a very simple game, but it's a fundamental game that we play to get really good off the ball movement, you know. And and rather than having 20 games that we play, like, say, for the 16A or 16 or senior teams, like, we get really, really good at fast break game, at full court press game, what now they're calling the high press in football. Yeah. Like, we would have been playing that in the 70s, you know. Well, that's, you know, the full court high pressure. You know, it's the same. The fundamentals and principles are the same, you know. And I asked Pat Dalton, of course, does in the '70s, like, how was the basketball so influential in everyone? And he made a point that basketball was a professional game in the early part of the last century, come back on and off in the '20s and thirties, like, and when you think of it, like, Heffo and Miko played in 1974 was probably the first time that we really had inverted commas the managers, you know. And 1974, which was half a century after basketball was professional, you know, like, so there was a huge amount of learning in the game of basketball, and for a long, long time before we got into coaching in our games.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Come here, so Pat, you weren't only just an all-round sportsman and a manager of all sorts of different teams across sports. You were into the music as well. So you were an accordion player and you were in the band called The Drowning Fish. And your manager at the time, /security guard, was none other than our own Cheddar Plunkett. And he joins us on the line now. Welcome back to the show, Cheddar.
Thanks, Willie. Say hello to Pat as well. How are things?
How are you, Chad? How are you going?
Good. Now, I'd say, Willie, that manager was a very loose term now. As far as that shower was concerned, it was more psychologist, driver, minder, any of those adjectives that would have described it a bit better, to be honest.
So that was it. The name of the band was The Drowning Fish, and that had to change to The Mere Mortals pretty quickly because Emotional Fish, Cheddar, kind of hit it big and ruins your name.
Yeah, they did a little bit all right, yeah. We sort of took a good business decision on that one at the time, Willie. Took a few weeks, actually, in thinking it out, to be honest with you. But, yeah, look, I suppose a lot we were sort of running gigs and bands and that at the time for a few years before that. And some of Pat's friends and my friends were into music, you know, were more into music, maybe more than sport and that. Including my own brother, Ollie, and Paul, and Paul Brophy and Dick Duff and a few of them, and I suppose between everything, put a band together as such, and you know, had great fun along the way. I suppose Pat had a key part to play in that. You know, obviously, you know, from his sport, he's a very creative person. So on the serious side, from songwriting and that was good, but he also had a fair part to play in the general mayhem that followed as well. So yeah, look, there were great times to be with Pat and great times to be together with that.
So Pat, just to give us an idea, like, I mean, you made the Dave Fanning show, you played at the Fela down in Turles, which was absolutely huge. I think I was at the last one in 95, Rage Against the Machine was at that. You toured the country in a little small van.
Yeah, I kind of started off as a joke where we were over on holidays in Spain. I remember it was the Ben Hur Hotel was the place where we were staying, and we got these T-shirts where we had a salmon diving into a pint of Guinness and the drowning fish, and Ollie convinced Antonio, who owned the departments, that we were a band, you know, and Ollie was just beginning to learn how to play the guitar at the time, and didn't Antonio book us in for a gig and in the lounge on the Thursday night, like, and that day it rained, so we were on the tear kind of during the day, and Ched and Billy Bond kind of saw what was kind of developing and cleared out, and it ended up there was Ollie with a guitar and myself and Benny Donovan with two hurls on the stage and three tequilas, and we started off the first night, it's another tequila sunrise, and lamped the three tequilas down, started into the first song, and myself and Benny were doing our impression of the ZZ Top moves with the hurls, and Ollie could play pretty good at the start, but when he tried to synchronize with our movements, he couldn't play at all, like, and the crowd started turning around, so I said to Ollie, says Ollie, I think we're losing the crowd here, but I may go solo, you know, and took out a Schlitter and started scrolling around, and I tapped it over this old lady's head and said, well, are you enjoying the gig? And she says, you're making a disgrace of the Irish, she said, you know. So I said, the band are enjoying it, you know. And that became our motto then, as long as the band enjoyed it, you know. But then when we got back and got going, then got a bit more serious about it, but we always had that crack along the way, like we're done. The Pogues were headlining down in Fela 90. We got the backstage passes. We had a brilliant weekend. But at one stage, Shane was tucking into a bottle of vodka in the tent. Like, and Paul Maron was our lead singer. I went to college with him, but I had lost most of my teeth from the hurling from an injury against Tip. Like, Ali says, Jesus, he says, there's my going over there, not hooking toot, and he said, and he never been wrong. great gallery, yeah. So as Cheddar said, we had changed to the Mere Mortals, and in between, I think we were we had a few other names in between, like we used to go down to the Rose of Tralee there and play down there. We actually would say that we played in the Pint Depot, but it was actually Charlie's Bar at the front of the Pint Depot, as where we got the gig, like, and and we always needed a big stage for kind of leaping around the place. But Cheddar and the lads went out and they got the car park signs or plywood, like, and built out the stage. But at one stage, myself and Paul Marin were jumping up and down to the chorus. So the plywood was rotten, like, we went straight through it, like, and once we knew we were gone, we disappeared all together, like, and the boys kept playing, and then we jumped up for the chorus, you know, like, and just the crowd went mad, then we came back up for the chorus, and this dope, like, saying that, Jez, the boys are, your man's a jewel, you know, and then he wanted, you should sue them for the stage, like, you know? and remember, it was good. Brilliant crack, like, Cheddar had to put up with a lot, like, those years, I tell you, trying to manage that.
Did you ever sack any of them, Cheddar?
No, there was a couple of meetings had, or a couple of meetings had at different times. It was absolutely savage crack. And at the time, we were all, you know, the hurling side of the band were sort of finishing up a little bit in the hurling. So you could do these things in, you know, the off season. But just look on the serious note, I don't know where the band were playing one. I think it might have been in the Bagadin. They used to play a lot in the Bagadin, which was a great live venue in Dublin at the time. And I think it was there that Matty Fox saw the band. Matty Fox obviously was manager of Christy Moore at the time for a good number of years, and would have managed a number of bands and that, and became very interested in the band. Actually, it got pretty serious at one stage. You know, the band would have produced, I suppose, a number of albums and singles and videos and TV shows and what have you, while at the same time, you know, having a great time. But I suppose everybody was working, like, so you just couldn't commit to a full time. But it got serious around that stage, actually, until we saw a little bit more sense and pulled back. But yeah, God, it was just fantastic fun and fantastic crack. Well, I'd say it was for the boys. For me, it was a little bit different because we could be playing in Galway, we could be playing in Limerick or something like that. And, you know, you'd be, by the time you have your stuff packed away and in the van, you might be leaving there at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And of course, the minute you'd leave Galway, is all you'd hear is snores. And you'd have to be into work then again the following morning. You might get home, get the breakfast, go straight into work, but look, it was brilliant. There were a great bunch of, you know, great lads, all great friends that were really interested in enjoying life. And I'd say Pat was the most creative on that side, is all I'll say.
Well, it's actually unusual, Pat. I don't know, when I was growing up, the lads that were into bands, and the lads that played the GAA were into the GAA. You know, they might play a bit of soccer, but wouldn't have been that much crossover between the music and the sport.
No, it wouldn't. And probably when Cheddar was saying there, when it did begin to get a little bit more serious, like, probably Cheddar couldn't book gigs around it because mainly myself and Des Rigney would have games, you know, whether it be rugby for Des or the hurling or football. But I remember we were saying that we should nearly step down at the bike because the other four guys were really into the music, like for Dick Duff and Ollie and Paul, the two Pauls, like, music was their number one, you know, like, and we felt we were holding them back, like, but the band just stayed together to enjoy the camaraderie as well. But Ollie has a music studio now, the Golden Egg studio is a fantastic setup out there. Dick Duff's still playing away there, like, anytime you watch Dick playing the drums, like, he just puts you in good fun, even looking at him, you know, let alone the rhythm that he has, you know. And I go and watch the Valves there that he plays with any chance of getting Portlaoise there. Portlaoise is a great town for live music venues before the COVID, and hopefully we'll get back to that. But remember, his mam was, we used to always hit Dick with the drummer jokes, you know, about a year or two, his mam was in at in the back of Cavanaugh's there at the gig, like, and afterwards we were chatting, and I said, Mrs. Duff, do you remember when Dick was a young lad, when he asked you about what he said when he was going to grow up, he was going to grow up to be a drummer, and do you remember what you said to him? You said, "No, Dick, you can't do both."
Which is a fair enough comment. Cheddar, how did you get them onto the Fela?
And I suppose we just had like a lot of things. You had friends around the place. At that stage, it was actually very, very difficult to get on. You know, Irish bands weren't treated anything like they were in later years. You know, if you had a gig like that or a support slot, generally speaking, the gig was run by the record company of the major band that was coming into Ireland. And of course, they'd only put on their own bands that were on their that were on in their stable as support slots. And it was quite difficult to do that. And equally, even just getting into Thurles and getting, you know, you'd really need to be in the charts and that sort of thing. Actually, the band were in the charts at the time, if my memory serves me correct, Pat. I think they went to number 10 with a single at the time. Now, there was some fair... Skullduggery went on to get it up to number 10, I can tell you. But I think we sort of friends around the place at the time, and of course you lean on people to open doors for you and to get into it. Actually, I remember another time, some of the older listeners I might remember, Bob the Rats played their first really, really big gig was in Paolo Foca House up in Wicklow. And about 10 years after that, I mean, the Rats were gone at this stage, and Bob Geldof was a solo at the time, and somebody decided it was a great idea to bring him back to Paolo Foca, and we actually supported him up there. But the first time that Bob played there was about 10 or 15,000 people at it. But the next time that he played there, which was the time we played there, was about 150 people at it. It wasn't anything as a successful gig. But to go back to your question, Willie, look, you just lean on people like you're doing a lot of things in life, I suppose.
What was Bob Geldof like, Pat?
We never got paid for that gig afterwards.
That's true.
I think he owes us for the gig, and I think Paul Maron owes him for a microphone. So that's it.
Did you make any money out of the band, Pat?
We got £50 the first Christmas from the manager there, and £100 the second Christmas, and we're still waiting for 150. In fairness, we just put the money back into producing videos and CDs and stuff like that. As Chad said, we managed to get it into the chart. We used to be on a program called The Beatbox. It was a Sunday morning program that showed music videos. So we featured on that a good bit. We played at a barbecue out at Tucker for that single that went into the charts. And I think it was you paid into the gig, and instead of it being a fiver, it was £7, and you got the CD. So there was maybe about 1,500 sold that night, like in one venue. So that kind of how we managed the charts part of it.
Yeah, and then when you left the Mere Mortals, then the Perfect Skins, the kind of change into that, and now Ollie Cheddar is in the Lost Messiahs. I actually acted in one of his videos there not so long ago. I played a scumbag, Cheddar, so I don't know whether I should read anything into that or not from Ollie.
I was surprised you were allowed into the last session in Fela, actually, Ollie, but I was looking at Ollie's studio there. A number of the lads were. We were all friends, I suppose, first of all. We were just talking about this particular subject. We were all friends, so they used to support us in the hurling. And it used to be a big, big group would follow our club hurling at the time, as well as county. So it was sort of a crossover between friends here, I suppose. A lot of the lads who were serious about music went on. And we're all interested in music, still are to this day, and so is Pat, but just not to the level that would have been back then. But look, it was just mayhem a lot of the time. It was great, great fun, great, great crack. And it was made really by the lads themselves. They were just great people, really, really funny people to be around.
A bit of hurling, Cheddar, before we finish up. So this is obviously a tribute show to Pat. I heard you saying on A Hurler's Life with Brian Carroll that he wasn't just a box-to-box midfielder, he was a parish-to-parish midfielder. So it was a fair way of summing up Pat's energy around the field.
I'd forgotten that, and unfortunately, I was one of the people that had to attest to that, I suppose. A lot of the time when we'd be training to play a bit in midfield, Pat played most of it in midfield, and, you know, we might be marking one another. And we had a trainer at the time, he's still with us, thankfully, Tom Lawler, and he had a fantastic way. We know we were talking there recently about game-based coaching. Now, he had a very strange way about game-based coaching, but it was around that, and was very much around the 15 and 15. And he'd have a different way of putting conditions on games. Throughout the game, one team might be 2 or 3 points ahead of the other. Now, that mightn't be the way it was on the scoreboard, but, of course, it would be hugely competitive, and it was my job to try and play on Pat. And you would, you know, like anything, you would do something. You might catch the ball and strike it, which when you look around, Pat could be the far end of the field. So here you were jogging off after him again, you know. So yeah, he was incredible, incredibly athletic player, Pat. I'm speaking now as if he's not a part of the show here. But even, I suppose there's a lot of players, Woolley, that have achieved a lot in a particular sport, but there's not that many players that have achieved a lot in a lot of sports. I mean, everybody knows Pat's hurling and football. I was lucky enough to see an awful lot of Division One National League basketball when Port Leisha and Port Arrington were Division One at the time. And Pat, I think, Pat, you correct me if I'm wrong, I think you were a point guard. I would have no doubt in saying this, and Pat will probably bait me after the show, that he was definitely the ability to play Irish international basketball from what I could see on it. And he just happened to turn up one day at a Leash Novice Cross Country Championship and just went out and won the bloody thing. So that sort of backs up my box to box or my parish to parish theory about Pat and the athleticism that he had. He was an incredibly athletic person.
Yeah, the one match I wanted to mention that the two of you, Pat, was the one. It's just heartbreaking for Portlaoise, really, because I don't think it ever was done before. It was the 1987 Leinster final. I was at this match. I was at both the football and the hurling matches. I remember being with them with the father. It was the goal in the last minute against Rathnure. You'd drawn with Parnells in the football. I think that was in Newbridge, and then he lost by a last minute goal to Rathnure, and then went and beat Parnells in the replay. Pat, it would have been a Leinster club double for Portlaoise.
Yeah, I think we played 13 weekends in a row, in that run, and as I said, we drew against Parnells, and the following Sunday was against Rathnure, and we really, when we look back in the game, we probably should have been 8 or 10 points up, but we were just 3, and they hit a goal, and then John Taylor broke from half back and put over a point from about 60 yards. I remember Paul Berg and then hit another point from the sideline about 50 yards under the stand. Like, there were 2 points, having got the sucker of the goal, there were 2 points to win any game, and it just went into injury time and kept going, and then suddenly they got the second goal. I remember Connie Conroy saying there that he went down with his mother, God rest her, and that they got into the car, and there wasn't a word said the whole way back. The supporters were just numb after the game, because we knew we had left it behind us. Kind of maybe a little bit similar in recent years there, when we lost to Ballyboden, I remember, in the football Leinster final. You know, we came out of the field and said, Jesus, how do we lose that game? But it kind of knocked the stuffing out of that team as well, you know. And then we beat Parnells in the replay the following Sunday. So it would have been a Leinster double that I don't think was ever achieved, and probably unlikely ever to be achieved, you know. So came very, very close to it.
What's your memory of that, Cheddar? Like, I mean, heartbreaking end to a game.
Yeah, the memory is very clear on it, Woolley, as the biggest regret in hurling for all of us. I'd say, you know, Pat obviously has had huge success at Intercounty and that, but probably from our club. We were never the same team after that. You know, that was I suppose that was the day that if we had won it, we might have went on and done other things. But incidentally, Pat coached and trained us in that. That's why we actually got there probably in the first place. But during that year, like, we would have beaten Offaly champions Rhinas and Glenmore, I think, from Kilkenny. My mind's a bit hazy here now, to be honest with you, but we'd have beaten a lot of teams. But actually, in the challenge matches throughout that summer, we would have beaten all the top clubs around. You know, we were really, really flying at the time. And we're just caught by a sucker punch, really, I suppose, in a great game. People often talk to me about that game, and it's a long time ago now. But yeah, huge regrets over it. As a team, we never recovered after that, to be honest.
You were player manager then, Pat, at that stage?
The player coach at that time. You know, in the early 80s, because you were going to the PE college, like George Eli or Nasser or Jimmy would say, well, the way to put it to you, will you do a few exercises there with the lads, you know? So I would gradually be doing a little bit at that stage, but in 87 then I was player coach. And yeah, as Cheddar said, like I remember one, even though it was only a challenge match in particular against Middleton, like Middleton had about six of the Cork team, like John Fenton, the Hart, Nitz Mulcahy, Kevin Hennessy, and we beat them by 9 or 10 points, like down just outside in a pitch just outside Mitchelton. It was a fabulous display, like it, but again, it was only the challenge match, and we lost the one that counted afterwards. Yeah, but it was a great time, but huge regret over that game above all the games we ever played.
That's the thing, because Cheddar, I was mentioning to Pat that in Portlaoise have only ever won 11 county titles in hurling, and you won 7 of them in 11 years, but you never won that Leinster, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it's a huge regret for that team. I suppose in the earlier part of it, Woolley, we just didn't put it into it. You know, the thinking at the time was to, you know, Portlaoise hadn't won a hurling for 43 years. And incidentally, has a great history in hurling going way, way back to the early years, but had lost out big time for a long time and hadn't won since 43. I think it was 81 when we won next. So got on a lot of momentum. Hurling was probably the number one sport in the town at the time, even though football was still winning. I suppose that was the apex, really, of the performance of that team. And then to lose a Leinster, and we sort of faded away. We came back to another Leinster in 98, maybe with the remnants of that team, but that team sort of broke up really at that stage. Still massive regret about that. I know there's an awful lot of your listeners that would be in the same boat, and that would have lost bigger games in terms of All-Irelands and inter-counties and all of that. But just for that group of players that had put a lot into it, and particularly that year, had shown real, real form, a very, very balanced team, great physicality about the team. That day it was in Nolan Park. It was a damp day, but yet the hurling was smashing hurling. And just to lose it in the circumstance that we did, we just never got back to that again for some reason.
Yeah. What, before I let the two of you go, Pat, I was asked to ask you, what's the James Stevens connection with Portlaoise? Because you managed them first. Niall Rigney managed them then about 10 years ago. And Cheddar managed them the last 2 years. Is that Georgie Lahey's club? Is that the connection, Pat? Or is this just kind of chance?
Well, I know I went down to coach them. As far as I'm aware, that there was some kind of rift or infight in the club, and they felt that it was the first time they ever went for someone outside to come in because of that. Like, I still don't know who was on either side of it. When you go into coach, you just coach like what you have in front of you, you know. And, two great years ago, we lost the semi final by a pint both times. DJ went off concussed the first year against Gore, and he came back on after being concussed and put a free over the bar for the win at the death from about 60 yards on the sideline. And we lost to a Loughlin's with two late pints in injury time the following year. The year after that, then it was actually the 2004 Willie that Portlaoise lost by, to Ballinade. They won the All-Ireland. Niall had a great run with them, and they won the county final with Niall, and Cheddar had a fantastic run with them there for the last 2 years. So it has developed as a great connection. They're a fantastic club, like, of it. Had a great experience down there, they loved their hurling, and they're a fantastic tradition. I remember when I went down, from a coaching perspective, you have to kind of make a connection, like, but I remember the first meeting that we had with them, that I said, I remember going on playing a challenge match against the village when we were a young team in the late 70s, and that the thrill that we had of actually playing the village showed the high regard that the club had throughout the country. You know, like, we were thrilled to be going down and playing against the Brian Codys and the Joe Hennessys of that time. And but then the other connection, I was like, in the room in front of me, I'd say most of the players in front of me had won an All-Ireland medal at some level, and some of them at the senior level. So I said to him that I can't talk to you about the experience of winning an All-Ireland in Croke Park, because I've never done that. I said, but what I can, like, they hadn't won a county final now for 20 years. Like, but I said, but I can talk to you about Rathdowney in 1981. That was the last year that the village had won a final. I said, but it was the first year that we won a final in 40 years. Like, and I can tell you about that experience, like, with all men crying in the field and the emotion. And I said, I want this group to have that experience again, you know, like, and we met great friends, as you do when you go on a journey like that down there, and still have great time for that club. I know Fan and Philly, Lark, my dad would have come down to a lot of the training sessions. And I remember saying to Philly that my dad had seen three Larkins win All-Irelands, Fan's dad, Fan and Philly, you know, like they were up at my dad's funeral. And great connections there.
There certainly is. Pat, I'm not going to take up any more of your time or Cheddar's. This was a tribute show to you, Pat. So thanks very much for taking the time out to do it. Like I said at the start, you're a Portlaoise and Laois legend. And one thing that always sticks out with me with you, Pat, is that you could go anywhere in Laois, despite any rivalries, any, you know, kind of talk like that. You could go anywhere in Ireland. And I'm yet to meet someone who would ever say anything even remotely negative about you, Pat. So I think that's a fair reflection of you as a person, and we know what you're like as a sportsman, as a manager, and a musician, as Cheddar's, after filling us in. So thanks very much, Pat, and we'll leave it at that. And thanks, Cheddar, as well.
Thanks, Willie.
We're going to play you out with the song that was played at the start of the show. It's called The Portlaoise Queen. It was written by Christy Conroy, and it's a great town song. So we'll play you out with that. We'll talk to you next week. Good luck.
In the year of the sunshine, the year 54, we said that we'd sail across the sea. A bunch of the boys, all natives of the town, we were going on a voyage, you see. With a lovely little boat, and when ready to float, she was the nicest that ever you'd seen. When not from digging where we land, the brass and reed band, they played us to the Portlaoise Queen. We had Big Jack Bun, who rose up with the sun, Jimmy here from the Central Hotel. With lively Larry Ging, like a bird on the wing, Frank Bean just the sound as a bell. We had Lawler from the bridge, Bob Delaney from the ridge, Charlie Wharton came up from the green. And for fearless Eddie Hume, we didn't make room on the crew of the Portlaoise Queen. Tommy Higgins, he supplied us with a toting for the trip. Bill Campbell gave us 10 barrels of stout. Mick Whalen, he threw in a few old bucks' legs and some rabbits with the mix, so there's no doubt. And as for Jimmy Brown, no, he didn't let us down, with apples and oranges nice and clean. Billy Dunn was the man with his noble horse and cart that brought him to the Portlaoise Queen. We were 9 days at sea between you and me. Sure, the boys weren't doing too well. Then the Laney, he got drunk, still all there was a skunk. Oh, then that started holy hell. They were fighting for a week until the boat took the leak. But Bean was a man so keen, steering back through the tides, he saved all the hides of the crew of the Portlaoise Queen. Now I'm back here again with those courageous men who braved the mountain tides with foaming cream. Just to keep your minds from troubling, our little boat's in Dublin, in a place called the National Museum. So my advice to you, would never venture out of blue. You may never more be seen. skill or care, but someone's prayer that saved us on the port of Eastern Queen.